The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Heather Stewart. This week,
austerity is coming to an end, but discipline will remain.
Philip Hammond announced this week in his budget that austerity is coming to an end and offered voters a down payment with tax breaks for middle earners, extra cash for universal credit, and a confirmation of Theresa May's £20 billion boost for the NHS. With Downing Street desperate to win over Tory backbenchers sceptical about May's leadership, just weeks away from the critical Brexit vote, there were modest handouts too for many of their cherished causes, from defence to potholes. Now the dust has settled, we'll look beyond the rhetoric and the terrible jokes at how Hammond's Brexit budget really stacks up, and whether he'll have to tear it all up next spring if Brexit goes wrong. Also this week, Angela Merkel announced that her fourth term as Chancellor would be her last.
Diese vierte Amtszeit ist meine letzte als Bundeskanzlerin der Bundesrepublik Deutschland.
John Henley will be looking back over her 13 years in power and asking what's next for Germany and the EU. But first, the naysayers were predicting higher taxes and higher borrowing. But then the Office for Budget Responsibility miraculously found billions of quid down the back of the sofa. And so, in an unexpectedly generous package, the Chancellor could fund an NHS increase, cut income tax, and find additional resources to help cushion the blow of the switch to universal credit. He also announced a slew of other short-term giveaways and a £400 million a year levy on large tech companies such as Google and Facebook, and won himself some much-needed positive headlines. The Mail plastered every page of its coverage with the feel-good factor. I'm joined to discuss by my expert panel, Matt Whitaker from the Resolution Foundation, Ryan Shorthouse from think tank Bright Blue, and Anushka Astana, presenter of The Guardian's brand new podcast, Today in Focus. Matt, just give us a little bit of the sort of economic background to this, because we'd expected it to be a tight budget, hadn't we?
Yeah, I mean, if you, 4 weeks ago, I think everybody was expecting it to be a very quiet budget, pre-Brexit, bit of a holding pattern, nothing too exciting. Obviously, the Chancellor knew that the Prime Minister was already promising lots of money for the NHS. And then she dropped the bombshell at the party conference that austerity was ending as well. So that was another big thing he had to get over the line. And if you add those two things up and then say, you know, the economy's still not doing great, that pointed to tax rises. But actually what's happened is over the last, well, the first 6 months of this year, for instance, the tax revenues we've had coming in have just been much stronger than the OBR projected they would be back in March. And so the OBR's taken a different view now and said, either we've now got a tax-richer economy, so the economic growth they've got is generating more tax than we thought it would, or the economy is actually growing more quickly than the official statistics tell us. Either way, they're saying now, we think, therefore, we're just doing a bit better than we thought. There's more revenue coming in. And in this year, that's completely fine, and they've given the Chancellor £12 billion this year to play around with. But what they've also then said is that's going to carry on over the next few years, and that becomes less certain. And as you say, the Chancellor decided to take that money and use it. The OBR gives, sometimes it takes away as well, and it'd be interesting to see what happens at the next statement.
As you say, we should be clear about that, shouldn't we? He's choosing to give away pretty much all of this sort of forecasting windfall. He could have tucked some of it away, couldn't he? He could have said, this, as you say, this could disappear as quickly as it's arrived. I'm going to set some of it aside.
Yeah, I mean, in total, they've given him something like £74 billion over 5 years of extra money, and he's used three quarters of it. So he's reduced borrowing cumulatively over that five-year period by £19 billion. But pretty much all of that is happening in the first couple of years. Once you get out to 2020 and beyond, he's actually sticking exactly to the borrowing trajectory he had in place back in the spring, and just using all the rest of that windfall to cover, primarily to cover the NHS, but also to do a few things around on universal credit and to give some of the members of his own party a bit of a fillip by announcing the tax cut a year earlier than we thought we'd get it.
Mm. Ryan, the politics of this are really interesting, aren't they? Theresa May obviously felt in her conference speech she needed to be able to say something to voters, even to some extent to her own party, about what the Tories are going to stand for after Brexit, you know, show that Brexit hasn't overwhelmed everything. So she talked about austerity. People needed to see that their hard work had paid off. It's quite a moment, really, isn't it?
It's quite a moment. And obviously, May is in search of a different narrative to Cameron. And that has to be a post-austerity narrative. But I think in announcing the end of austerity, I think the government is in danger of being too clever by half. And in trying to appeal to everybody is not appealing to anyone. You know, what we have now is the original target of getting the structural deficit eliminated by the mid-2020s, gone. And it strikes me that the Conservative Party seems to be going away from the need for fiscal discipline and them standing for that. And they've kind of moved away from that. But at the same time, although there's this sort of rhetoric of abandoning austerity, we're still going to get fiscal retrenchment. And particularly for people on low incomes who, in all honesty, they're the ones who have felt austerity the most because of the cuts to working age benefits. Yes, the restoration of the two work allowances in universal credit is a good move. We've welcomed it, as along with others. But the background to all of this is that still there are big cuts to working age benefits, not least because of the freeze on most other benefits year to year. And even if the spending taps are turned on, which, by the way, is contingent on getting a Brexit deal, it's still the case that the NHS, International Development Department, Defence, are going to swallow a lot of that. So, you know, despite the rhetoric, a lot of people on low incomes and a lot of departments aren't going to feel that austerity is over.
So you lose sort of Conservatives and Conservative voters who might want to see their party being rather tight on rather disciplined on spending, but at the same time you don't gain a lot of people because they can see that austerity is still continuing, or it feels to people in their sort of daily lives that austerity is still continuing.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you're in the middle of the road, aren't you? And, you know, there's that famous saying about if you get in the middle of the road, you get run over. And I think there's a slight danger with that. And, you know, at the end of the day, people know the Conservative Party is there to clean up the economy and to get fiscal discipline. So moving away from that, you know, moving away from stressing the need for fiscal discipline, I think is a risky strategy.
It's pretty extraordinary, Inishka, in some ways, to hear Philip Hammond adopting what's really been the narrative of Labour. It's Jeremy Corbyn who's talked about austerity, who's talked about the impact of cuts, and suddenly, you know, there was a feeling that the Tories were having to respond to that in a way perhaps they haven't.
Well, if you wind your mind back to the election of 2017, it feels like we've talked about nothing but Brexit since, but actually the Tory MPs were talking to you and me, Heather, at the time. What they were essentially saying was they were getting school cuts, they were getting health cuts on the doorstep, and they were really worried about it, and they wanted to move Big Phil before this budget, frankly, but clearly Theresa May has finally managed to make him do it. I think the interesting thing is what does an average person actually think ending austerity means? Because it's such a kind of vague term in a way. And I had this polling last night that I was looking at, and it's quite interesting because it's not, for example, getting the deficit down. It's very specifically more money on public services, which they may be getting through the NHS, but also the end of spending cuts. And actually, if you take out the three departments that have their budgets protected, so international aid, health and defence, actually spending cuts are continuing in other departments. So it'll be interesting to see whether people actually buy it, to be honest. Clearly, Labour will be pushing that that is not what has happened. You know, it becomes an argument about rhetoric, really, rather than an argument about reality.
Yeah, and one of the big choices they made was that tax cut, wasn't it? It's interesting if people do see public services as being the real measure of whether austerity has ended, you wonder about that decision to bring forward those tax cuts, which were in the Tory manifesto, but they're going to do it earlier than expected, aren't they, Matt?
Yeah, politics is always about choices, obviously. And having been given the money, you then make a choice about what you're going to do with it once you've decided that you are going to actually use all of it rather than bank it for lowering the deficit. And so to choose to spend what in the end is going to be £2.8 billion on this tax cut, with half of that going to the top 10% of income households in total, that's a clear choice. That is a choice to say, we've got £2.8 billion to spend, we're putting £1.4 billion of that straight into the pockets of those at the very top. And that's, I think, you know, perfectly legitimate decision you can make, particularly as a Conservative government, but it's a slightly odd one to make, I would say, at a time when you are being charged with trying to end austerity and making a visible difference to what's going on with public services, and you've still got billions of pounds worth of cuts to working age welfare coming through as well.
Is that right, Ryan? Do you think it's an odd choice?
Yes, I think it's, you know, obviously the raising of the personal tax allowance has been something that's been started from 2010. And every time it's gone up, it's become even more poorly targeted. And also that alongside increasing the threshold for paying high rate tax, that is also very poorly targeted. I'm not against tax cuts. You know, it could have been that they focused on raising the threshold for paying employees national insurance, which starts at a much lower salary than personal income.
So lower earners would benefit.
Lower earners would benefit. But it does seem, you know, if you know, as I said, austerity, I think, has hit the poorest the most. They've felt it the most in terms of the cuts to working age benefits. So it seems strange that if you're trying to move beyond that, that you would focus on bringing forward this tax cut instead of focusing on benefits and going much further than restoring the work allowances and the universal credit. And, you know, the other thing is the fuel duty freeze, which has been done 9 years now in a row. And that is also incredibly expensive and poorly targeted. So I'm not against tax cuts. I think tax cuts can be a good move. But I think the ones in this budget were not correct.
And yet, Anushka, Labour has ended up saying it wouldn't oppose that increase in the higher rate threshold. What's going on there?
Well, it's a bit weird, isn't it? I mean, you could literally set out who wins from this and show that you've got a massive bag of cash for the richest people. And a point that we've also talked about a lot, you know, the very poorest get nothing from the personal tax allowance going up because huge numbers of people earn below the 12 and a half grand that we're talking about. And there you've got a very socialist shadow chancellor. He wouldn't reverse it. I mean, I think to some extent, is this rude? I'm going to say it anyway. To some extent, John McDonnell says what he thinks is right at that moment in an interview. And when he's asked about something like this, it doesn't feel right to say we're going to reverse tax cuts in the future because you wouldn't want to take money out of people's pockets. But, you know, actually, it's not really what he stands for. And I thought there was this interesting comment from Lisa Nandy, MP yesterday, who's very upset about Labour's position on this, which is, I think, if it were to come to a vote that they would abstain, although I don't know if it really would come to a vote, but she made a very good point that she would rebel on that point. And if Jeremy Corbyn was still on the back benches, he would very certainly be in the lobby with her on that.
Yeah, it certainly raised a kind of wry smile on the back benches, I think, among some people, it's fair to say, because back in the day, you know, you might have had, say, Ed Balls, previous Shadow Chancellor, saying, you know, we can't do this because we'll be clobbered at the ballot box. And, you know, it would have been very much Jeremy and John castigating him for that, I think it's fair to say. Matt, how much of this will stand if we don't get the Brexit deal that the government hopes for?
God, they really are through the looking glass at that point, I think. I mean, I actually think, look, we don't know whether there's going to be a deal or not, do we? And if there isn't, then clearly we need to redraw up everything. And all of the announcements that the Chancellor made earlier this week, I think, would be, you know, up for grabs again. But I think actually what's much more likely is that we do get a deal. And then he's already hinted in the budget that we can revisit the spending plans he's set out. And that actually, although what he's done so far is just ease austerity on the public services, but not end it, I think what he's saying is if and when we get a deal and then I get some even better figures from the OBR, plus I've still got my fiscal headroom, which I've not yet tapped into. He's very deliberately kept precisely the same level of fiscal headroom despite spending all that he's spent. Then I can throw that money around as well. And then I think that's when you'd see a bit more money going into education and some of those other departments that still at the moment are facing cuts.
Which is next year, right? We get a spending review next year, presumably once we know what kind of Brexit deal we've ended up with. What's the OBR said so far about the impact of the Brexit deal on the economy? It doesn't know exactly what kind of deal we're going to get. What's it assuming?
So it's taking a really sort of mid-course between the idea that we might get no deal or a bad deal, or that we might get some sort of EEA type deal. And so all of its projections at the moment are just based on a relatively neutral stance, which is why the Chancellor is saying that there is this possibility of a deal dividend, because he's saying that as and when we get a deal, it's better than the OBR is currently assuming. Therefore, the OBR will upgrade all its forecasts. But I think the OBR would also say, yes, you know, if we get a better deal than it is currently plugged into its assumptions, that will be better for growth. But it will have other dynamic effects through the economy as well, which might change, you know, might change the level of inflation, for instance. And therefore, the assumption that there'll be another windfall off the back of a Brexit deal is an uncertain one, to say the least. And I think there is this fiscal firepower, is what Phil Hammond's calling it, still in his back pocket. But would he use it? Would he use it really? Because no Chancellor ever gets to the stage where they don't have any headroom. And particularly taking Ryan's point before, the idea that the Conservative government wants to still be the party of fiscal discipline. The idea
he talks about discipline. Austerity's over, but discipline isn't, I think.
Yeah, the idea that he's going to run right up to the limits of his own mandate just strikes me as not a particularly certain idea.
So it's about the politics, isn't it, of trying to show that Brexit is... He feels he's not allowed to say... talk about how risky Brexit is, and so he's, you know, talking about the benefits of a good deal rather than the terrible risks of a bad deal, because he gets accused of being Eeyore and all sorts of things, doesn't he, by the Brexiters. Hey, has he done enough to win over some of those Tory backbenchers who are perhaps sceptical of May's leadership and perhaps wondering about whether they can back whatever Brexit deal she comes back with?
I think there was genuinely a very positive response from the Tory backbenchers to the budget. They felt that there was a lot of retail stuff in there which they could sell on the doorstep, and that was something in the 2017 election they felt that that manifesto that Theresa May had delivered didn't have enough of, and Labour's very good at that clear retail offer. So a lot of backbenchers were genuinely very excited about it. But I think the positioning that we're in just points to the fact that the country is in a state of limbo. It's a sort of government on hold, not only because of Brexit, but also because of this strange positioning that they've carved out for themselves, where there's no longer a genuine commitment to austerity, but equally, there's no real plan to escape from it. So it just feels very much in limbo. And what I would say about Brexit is that it's incredibly divisive now. The referendum did not put an end to this issue that David Cameron wanted.
No.
It's just opened it up. And at the end of the day, I think for political and moral reasons, the Tory party needs to get a deal, to compromise, to get a deal as soon as possible and move on from the issue. If they go into the next election still talking about Brexit, if it's an election framed around Brexit, because the country is so divided, it will be very difficult for them to secure a majority. This is what happened in the 2017 election. A lot of people, rightly or wrongly, thought Labour were offering a softer Brexit, so went to Labour. And because it's so divided, I just think the Tory party needs to get that deal, not be puritanical about it, not be ideological about it, get the deal and move on.
Ryan's right, there were a lot of things you could mention on the doorstep, weren't there? I had a moment on Monday afternoon where I thought, oh God, this sounds like a pre-election budget, Anushka, I can hardly bear the thought of it, but that's one possibility they might be having to prepare themselves for, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, didn't everyone's mind turn to Brenda? Do you remember Brenda, who was like, oh God, not another one? I can imagine that she might be worried right now, because as you say, it was all the kind of giveaways that you'd like to have. Although hasn't Theresa May also said that she's not going to have another snap election? Now, I know she said that before, but
she did
surely
say that before, Anushka.
Surely she's learned her lesson. I mean, you can't just go there. I mean, one thing that's quite interesting is, you know, on those tax cuts that we're talking about, you know, let's be honest about it. They're not trying to help the poor. They're trying to help people who they think are going to vote for them. It has never helped people at the very bottom. And people have been a bit dishonest about it, I think. But it does really, really help a lot of people with salaries and who the Tories think might vote for them. And I think it suggests that she's still going for perhaps some of those similar groups that she was thinking about in 2017.
The sort of just about managings.
Yeah.
Rather the people than who are the bottom end of the scale.
A bit above 12.5 grand, but not, you know, right at the bottom.
Ryan, we should just talk a bit. We talked a bit about the political backdrop, but, you know, there were some very lurid headlines last week about Theresa May was entering the killing zone and she was only going to last another 5 minutes. And, you know, it feels as though we've had umpteen cycles of this. Does the budget kind of help or hinder that? Or does it just kind of, you know, go away after you've got a couple of days of headlines and everyone's back on to Brexit again? Is she any more secure than she was a week ago?
Well, she's the great survivor.
She really is.
People keep briefing these horrible things, but she keeps ongoing. And I think the budget probably helped marginally on that. But I think most Tory MPs realise the fact that if they're going to have a change of leader now, it would just be disastrous and pointless. It's still going to be the same with the European Union in the negotiations, regardless who the leader is, unless there's a completely radical new blueprint. But that just ain't going to happen. So, you know, a lot of people say, soon as Brexit's over, you know, will Brexit ever be over?
Yeah.
But as soon as the deal is in place, then that'll be the end. I think, you know, if she gets a deal in place, remember, her whole government at the moment is fixated and associated with Brexit. So if she gets a deal, she can, of course, then say to the electorate, well, I've kind of succeeded. So
I've done the thing I'm here to do.
I've done the thing that I'm here to do. So on that basis, she would be seen as successful. So why would she want to step down? I think the point comes more when we get closer to 2022, if that's when the election is. A lot of people think, well, she didn't really perform at the 2017 election. She showed that actually on the spot campaigning, she didn't really have the skills to be able to do that. So I suspect, you know, a year before that, there may be a debate within the Tory party about who the leader should be. But I think it's a few years. Theresa May's got a few years as a leader left in her.
Do you think that's right, Anushka? A lot of people at Westminster talk about getting rid of the poor woman as soon as she's got the deal done next spring.
I was speaking to Nikki Morgan, Tory MP, last week, and she's giving her backing now, but was pretty convinced that she'd be out of the job within a year. And I think that's probably quite true. Whether the party's problems go away, I'm not so sure. I mean, what I think the referendum did was essentially tilt the political axis onto a diagonal. And there's, you know, really interesting data out there that shows that while people used to define themselves by party political identity, Labour or Tory, nowadays they hardly do that at all. But a large majority of people do see themselves as either Leave or Remain. Now, that draws a line right down the middle of the Tory party and right down the middle of the Labour Party. And I think it makes for uncomfortable reading on both sides of the aisle for quite some time. And, you know, I look at these people and you kind of don't see them in the same party together at all. Jacob Rees-Mogg, Nicky Morgan. How do you ever get to a place where they are on the same side of the political aisle? As you say, maybe you get past Brexit, but that's not going to happen that quickly. No one's necessarily going to be happy with a fudge. And I think all the budget really does is give them a couple of days to be on the same team.
With that, Anushka, we should probably ask you about your new podcast.
Yay! I've had 4 hours sleep getting the first episode out, but it's very, very exciting. I very much miss working with you, Heather.
Yeah, you see, you thought this was going to be a breeze, didn't you, after being joint political editor? But no, it turns out you've only had 4 hours sleep.
4 hours sleep, yeah. The podcast kept me awake till 2. Children woke me up at 6. You know how it is.
I do know how it is.
Yeah, it's really exciting. It's called Today in Focus. We're going to be doing one big story in depth every day, showcasing some journalist in The Guardian. Heather has already had many calls from me about when she's first going to come on, because we're going to want to do a lot of UK politics, a lot of Brexit, and we're going to be using our columnists, especially when they do exciting things like Polly Toynbee did, confronting George Osborne in person. That gave us a brilliant first episode. Lots of international news as well. We've covered Bolsonaro today. And I think what we're going to ask is just give us 20 minutes of your time in your morning commute. And we'll teach you something new and hopefully entertain you as well.
Thank you all very much. Well, you can find out more about the budget or podcasts at theguardian.com.
Today in Focus is a new Guardian podcast that brings you closer to our journalism by getting behind the news every weekday. You'll join me, Anushka Astana, talking to people at the centre of the big stories impacting our world. We'll use personal perspectives and expert analysis to put you at the heart of what matters. Listen to Today in Focus and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you choose to listen.
And now, on Monday, German Chancellor Angela Merkel announced that she would not seek re-election as head of her ruling centre-right CDU party and that her fourth term as Chancellor would be her last. It heralds the end of an era in which she's dominated European politics, serving as Chancellor and the EU's de facto leader for the past 13 years. But her departure comes as the continent's political stability is at greater risk than any time since the end of the Second World War. Our Europe correspondent John Henley joins me now on the line to discuss. John, did Angela Merkel jump or was she pushed?
That's a very interesting question. I mean, I think she realised that her position was untenable as it was, largely because of these two very disappointing state election results in Bavaria and Hesse over the last couple of weeks, when her party, the CDU, you know, lost 10, 11, 12 points over its previous score. But that said, you know, she's been weakened since last year's federal election, which saw the rise of the AfD, and she was sort of forced to form this unpopular and pretty feeble coalition to renew it with the Social Democratic Party. And I think what she wants to do above all else is to ensure a smooth and orderly succession. That's the most important thing. And she's hoping that she can achieve that in a kind of a two-stage retirement, really. The first is to give up the leadership of the CDU, which she'll do in December at the party's Congress when they have to elect a new leader. And she hopes that she'll be able to stay on until the next federal elections as Chancellor. They're due in 2021. I mean, whether she will be able to do that or not, though, is actually pretty much out of her control. Really.
Right. I was going to say, because, you know, thinking in sort of British frame, you would think as soon as a leader announces their departure date, they're immediately a sort of lame duck and the process tends to sort of accelerate. Could she have a smooth exit in this way?
That's really the question, the nub of the question. I mean, you know, there is a school of thought here and actually in Brussels, which says that she might actually be more effective as Chancellor once she's sort of, you know, a bit more aloof from the, you know, the kind of internal intra-party squabbling.
I think Theresa May might quite like to do the same thing.
Exactly.
I'm sure she'd like to give up having to run the Tory party and just be
Prime Minister.
Yeah,
she might be able to be a bit more bold and you know, and to sort of take some decisions that she wouldn't have dared take when she still had to listen, for example, to the, you know, to the sort of conservative wing of her party. But, you know, I think in order for her to be able to stay, two things have to happen, really. The first is that the CDU, her party, has to elect somebody who is a Merkel ally as their next leader. You know, it's very hard to imagine that she could stay on as Chancellor if the party elected a much more conservative, you know, socially conservative and sort of economically liberal figure. Somebody like, for example, Friedrich Merz, who is kind of the front runner at the moment, who, you know, is a pretty hawkish character and who, you know, was at a press conference he gave yesterday, you know, which he said, you know, national identity and questions of immigration and so on were going to have to be much more at the forefront of the party's policy as it moved forward. So, and he's in the lead at the moment. If he is elected, according to the polls at least, if he's elected, then it's very hard to see how Merkel could stay on, because he is going to want to call early elections and to sort of, you know, fight them on his terms, etc., etc. So that would make life difficult for her. But the other thing, I mean, let's not forget the other thing, probably even more important than that, in whether or not she's going to have to go early, is the SPD, the Social Democrats, her coalition partner. I mean, they are in this, what looks like a status kind of terminal decline in the polls. They've done absolutely disastrously. Their lowest scores ever in these two regional elections. And there's a whole raft more regional elections coming up, or state elections coming up next year, plus the European Parliament elections. And, you know, it's quite clear to many in the Social Democrat Party that it's their membership of the coalition that is doing them all this damage in the polls. On the other hand, they know that early elections would, you know, they do very badly in early elections. But if they continue to do as catastrophically as this, then there's going to be a kind of a growing push from within the SPD to say, look, you know, it might be disastrous, but we just have to get out of this government and try and rebuild ourselves in opposition. And if they decide to do that, then it's curtains for Merkel equally, you know, much earlier. Some people here think it could happen as early as next spring, you know, after the European Parliament elections. So, yeah, as I say, it really is kind of out of her hands.
And to what extent should we see it sort of in the context of, you know, the kind of rise of populism, you know, the sorts of things that Emmanuel Macron likes to see himself as being against, you know, sort of identity politics and anti-migrant politics. And, you know, to what extent is that the sort of frame of some of this?
Well, she's widely seen as kind of a bulwark, as having been a bulwark against that style of politics. And I think it's very clear that her whole way of doing politics, you know, this incredibly kind of calm, measured, methodical, kind of tight-lipped, consensus-building, moderate approach to politics is very much out of kilter with, you know, with the age, really. I mean, you know, I mean, it was, of course, it was mere coincidence, but you can't help but note that the extraordinary contrast between, you know, her announcement of her planned departure at the beginning of this week was pretty much coincided with the election of Bolsonaro in Brazil, you know. And you've got people like Orban and Salvini, you know, who are so far removed from Merkel's vision of doing politics. But, you know, there is, you have also to ask, and I think that it's a question that's worth asking, you know, the extent to which Merkel's style of politics may actually, if not created, at least kind of enabled or helped contribute to the rise of these kind of populist politics. This kind of, you know, technocratic, managerial, there is no alternative approach. You know, that we don't need to explain, we know what we're doing and we'll sort it out. And, you know, I think it's worth asking whether or not that has helped contribute to this thing. And there's no doubt that her character, this sort of very kind of, you know, quietly spoken, unflappable, undemonstrative, you know, her speeches are deadly dull. Nobody can ever remember a speech that she's given. She you know, she's the absolute reverse of a kind of opposite of a kind of flamboyant or rhetoricist and orator. And that really fits with the German mood. I mean, she was really appreciated for that in Germany. Germany, for obvious historical reasons, doesn't like inflammatory speech makers, you know. But, you know, somewhere, and certainly her decision to what you might call her, you know, the boldest decision, perhaps the one really big, bold decision she made in 2015 at the height of the migration crisis, Europe's migration crisis, to allow, you know, more than a million refugees and asylum seekers into Germany. You know, that certainly was directly responsible for an increase in the popularity of the Alternative for Germany, the Germany's populist party. And you could see her whole approach, this, as I said, this kind of, you know, technocratic, no alternative approach. You could see Alternative for Germany in the title of the party. You know, the name of the party is Alternative, basically saying, yes, there is an alternative to this style of politics. So I think, you know, it's not as cut and dried as all that. We laud her for her admirably restrained and cautious and careful and kind of look before you leap and preferably don't leap at all style. But, you know, I mean, I think there is a sense in which it could have helped contribute to the rise of this very different kind of politics that we're in at the moment.
John, thank you very much. That's it for this week. My thanks to all my other guests, Matt Whitaker, Ryan Shorthouse and Anushka Astana. The producer was Simon Barnard. I'm Heather Stewart. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.